When we survey the parade of characters that has marched out of the imagination of storytellers from Homer to Shakespeare, Dickens, Austen, Hemingway, Williams, Wilder, Bergman, and all other masters, each character fascinating, unique, sublimely human, and so many, many of them, and realize that all were born of a single humanity. It's astounding. Because all creativity and labor that goes into designing story and character must finally be realized on the page, let's look at the text, dialogue and description, and the craft that guides its writing. Then, beyond text, let's examine the poetics of story, the image systems embedded in words that ultimately result in filmic images enriched in meaning and emotion. Eavesdrop on any coffee shop conversation, and you realize in a heartbeat you'd never put that slush on screen. Real conversation is full of awkward pauses, poor word choices and phrasing, non sequiturs. It seldom makes a point or achieves closure. But that's okay, because conversation isn't about point-making and closure-achieving. It's what psychologists call keeping the channel open. Talk is how we develop and change relationships. When two friends meet on the street and talk about the weather, don't we know that theirs isn't a conversation about the weather? What is being said? I am your friend. Let's take a minute out of our busy day and stand here in each other's presence and reaffirm that indeed we are friends. They might talk about sports, weather, shopping, anything, but as always, the scene is not about what the scene is about. Screen dialogue, therefore, must have the swing of everyday talk, but content well above normal. First, compression and economy. Screen dialogue must say the maximum in the fewest possible words. Second, direction. Each exchange of dialogue must turn the beats of the scene in one direction or another across the changing behaviors without repetition. Third, purpose. Each line or exchange of dialogue executes a step in design that builds and arcs the scene around its turning point. All this precision, yet it must sound like talk, using an informal and natural vocabulary complete with contraction, slang, and even if necessary, profanity. Remember, film is not a novel. Dialogue is spoken and gone. If words aren't grasped the instant they leave the actor's mouth, annoyed people suddenly whisper, "What did he say?" Nor is film theater. We watch a movie. We hear a play. The aesthetics of film are 80% visual, 20% auditory. We want to see, not hear, as our energies go to our eyes, only half listening to the soundtrack. Theater is 80% auditory, 20% visual. Our concentration is directed through our ears, only half looking at the stage. The playwright may spin elaborate and ornate dialogue, but not the screenwriter. Screen dialogue demands short, simply constructed sentences, generally a movement from noun to verb to object, or noun to verb to complement, in that order. Not, for example, "Mr. Charles Wilson Evans, the chief financial officer at Data Corporation in the 666 building on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, who was promoted to that position 6 years ago after graduating magnum cum laude from Harvard Business School, was arrested today, accused by the authorities of embezzlement from the company's pension fund and fraud in his efforts to conceal the losses." But with a polish. "You know Charlie Evans? CFO at Data Corp? Ha! Got busted. Had his fist in the till. Harvard grad ought to know how to steal and get away with it." The same ideas broken into a series of short, simply constructed, informally spoken sentences, and bit by bit, the audience gets it. Read your dialogue aloud to avoid tongue twisters or accidental rhymes and alliterations, such as, "They're moving their car over there." Never write anything that calls attention to itself as dialogue. Anything that jumps off the page and shouts, "Oh, what a clever line am I." The moment you think you've written a particularly brilliant and memorable line of dialogue that film lovers will quote with affection for decades to come, cut it. Long speeches are antithetical with the aesthetics of cinema. A column of dialogue from top to bottom of the page asks the camera to dwell on an actor's face for a talking minute. Watch a second hand crawl around the face of a clock for a full 60 seconds, and you'll realize that a minute is a long time. Within 10 or 15 seconds, the audience's eye absorbs everything visually expressive and the shot becomes redundant. It's the same effect as a stuck record repeating the same note over and over. When the eye is bored, it leaves the screen, and when it leaves the screen, you lose the audience. Writers with literary sensibilities often shrug this problem off, thinking the editor can break up long speeches by cutting to the listening face. But this only introduces new problems. Now an actor is speaking off-screen, and when we disembody a voice, the actor must slow down and over-articulate, because the audience, in effect, lip-reads. 50% of its understanding of what is being said, it gets by watching it being said. When the face disappears, it stops listening. So off-screen speakers must carefully spit out words in the hope the audience won't miss it. What's more, a voice off-screen loses the subtext of the speaker. The audience has the subtext of the listener, but that may not be what it's interested in. Therefore, be very judicious about writing long speeches. If, however, you feel that it's true to the moment for one character to carry all the dialogue while another remains silent, write the long speech. But as you do, remember, there's no such thing in life as a monologue. If, as an actor, I have a long speech that begins when another character enters, and my first line is, "You've kept me waiting," how do I know what to say next until I see the reaction to my first words? If the other character's reaction is apologetic, their head goes down in embarrassment, that softens my next action and colors my lines accordingly. If, however, the other actor's reaction is antagonistic, as he shoots me a dirty look, that may color my next lines with anger. How does anyone know, from one moment to the next, what to say or do until they sense the reaction to what they just did? They don't know. Life is always action-reaction. No monologues, no prepared speeches. Life is an improvisation, no matter how we mentally rehearse our big moments. Therefore, show us that you understand film aesthetics by breaking long speeches into patterns of action-reaction that shape the speaker's behavior. Fragment the speech with descriptions of silent reactions that cause the speaker to change the beat, such as this from Amadeus, as Salieri confesses to a priest. Salieri: "All I ever wanted was to sing to God. He gave me that longing, then made me mute. Why? Tell me that." The priest looks away, pained and embarrassed, so Salieri answers his own question rhetorically. Salieri: "If he didn't want me to praise him with music, why implant the desire, like a lust in my body, and then deny me the talent?" Or put parentheticals within the dialogue for the same effect, such as this from a later scene in Amadeus. Salieri: "You understand, I was in love with the girl." Parentheses: "Amused by his own choice of words." Close parentheses. "Or at least in lust." Parentheses: "Seeing the priest look down at the crucifix held in his lap." Close parentheses. "But I swear to you, I never laid a finger on her. No." Parentheses: "As the priest looks up, solemn, judgmental." Close parentheses. "All the same, I couldn't bear to think of anyone else touching her." Parentheses: "Angered at the thought of Mozart." Close parentheses. "Least of all, the creature." A character can react to himself, to his own thoughts and emotions, as does Salieri above. That, too, is part of the scene's dynamics. demonstrating on the page the action-reaction patterns within characters, between characters in the physical world, projects the sensation of watching a film into the reader's imagination, and makes the reader understand that yours is not a film of talking heads. In ill-written dialogue, useless words, especially prepositional phrases, float to the ends of sentences. Consequently, meaning sits somewhere in the middle. But the audience has to listen to those last empty words, and for that second or two, they're bored. What's more, the actor across the screen wants to take his cue from that meaning, but has to wait awkwardly until the sentence is finished. In life, we cut each other off, slicing the flabby tails off each other's sentences, letting everyday conversation tumble. This is yet another reason why, in production, actors and directors rewrite as they trim speeches, trying to lift the scene's energy and get the cueing rhythm to pop. Excellent film dialogue tends to shape itself into the periodic sentence. If you didn't want me to do it, why'd you give me that look, gun, kiss? The periodic sentence is the suspense sentence. Its meaning is delayed until the very last word, forcing both actor and audience to listen to the end of the line. The best advice for writing film dialogue is don't. Never write a line of dialogue when you can create a visual expression. The first attack on every scene should be, how could I write this in a purely visual way and not have to resort to a single line? If we write for the eye, when dialogue comes, as it must, it sparks interest because the audience is hungry for it. Lean dialogue, in relief against what's primarily visual, has salience and power. The silence. Esther and Anna are sisters living in a lesbian and rather sadomasochistic relationship. Esther is seriously ill with tuberculosis. Anna is bisexual and has an illegitimate child and enjoys tormenting her older sister. They're traveling home to Sweden, and the film takes place in a hotel during their journey. Ingmar Bergman has written a scene in which Anna goes down to the hotel restaurant and allows herself to be seduced by the waiter in order to provoke her sister with this afternoon affair. The waiter seduces the customer scene. How would you write it? Does the waiter open the menu and recommend certain items? Ask her if she's staying at the hotel, traveling far, compliment her on how she's dressed? Does she know the city? Mention that he's getting off work and would love to show her the sights? Talk, talk, talk? No. Here's what Bergman gave us. The waiter walks to the table and accidentally on purpose drops the napkin on the floor. As he bends to pick it up, he slowly sniffs and smells Anna from head to crotch to foot. She, in reaction, draws a long, slow, almost delirious breath. Cut to, we're in a hotel room. Perfect, isn't it? Erotic, purely visual, not a word said or necessary. That's screenwriting. Alfred Hitchcock once remarked, when the screenplay has been written and the dialogue has been added, we're ready to shoot. The ontology of the screen is an absolute present tense in constant vivid movement. We write screenplay in the present tense because, unlike the novel, film is on the knife edge of the now. Whether we flash back or forward, we jump to a new now. And action. Even static shots have a sense of aliveness, because although the imagery may not move, the audience's eye constantly travels the screen, giving stationary imagery energy. And, unlike life, film is vivid. Occasionally, our daily routine may be broken by light glinting off a building, flowers in a shop window, or a woman's face in the crowd. But as we walk our days, we're more inside our heads than out, half seeing, half hearing the world. The screen, however, is intensely vivid for hours on end. Vividness springs from the names of things. Nouns are the names of objects, verbs the names of actions. to write vividly, avoid generic nouns and verbs with adjectives and adverbs attached, and seek the name of the thing. Not, the carpenter uses a big nail, but the carpenter hammers a spike. Nail is a generic noun. Big is an adjective. The solid Anglo-Saxon spike pops a vivid image in the reader's mind. Nail, a blur. How big? The same applies to verbs, a typical line of nondescription. He starts to move slowly across the room. How does someone start to move across a room? The character either crosses or takes a step and stops. Move slowly? Slowly is an adverb. Move, a vague, bland verb. Instead, name the action. He pads across the room. He ambles, strolls, moseys, saunters, drags himself, staggers, waltzes, glides, lumbers, tiptoes, creeps, slouches, shuffles, waddles, minces, trudges, teeters, lurches, gropes, hobbles across the room. Each of those is a slow human movement, specific and different from all others. Name the action. Eliminate is and are throughout. On screen, nothing is in a state of being. Story life is a relentless flux of change, of becoming. Not, there is a big house on a hill above a small town. There is, they are, it is, she, he is, are the weakest possible ways into any English sentence. And what's a big house? Mansion? Hacienda? A hill? Ridge? Bluff? A small town? Crossroads? Hamlet? Perhaps a chateau guards the headlands above the village. With a Hemingway-esque shunning of adjectives and adverbs, and the most specific active verbs and nouns possible, even establishing shots come alive. Description requires an imagination and a vocabulary. Eliminate all metaphor and simile that cannot pass this test. What do I see or hear on screen? As Milos Forman observed in film, a tree is a tree. As if, for example, is a trope that doesn't exist on screen. A character doesn't come through a door as if he comes through the door, period. The metaphor, a chateau guards, and the simile, the door slams like a gunshot, pass the test in that a castle can be photographed from a foreground angle that gives the impression it shelters or guards the village below it. A door slam can crack the ear like a gunshot. In fact, in the film Missing, the sound effects of all door slams were done with gunshots to subliminally increase tension, as the conscious mind hears a door slam, but the unconscious reacts to a gunshot. These, on the other hand, taken from submissions to the European Script Fund, the sun sets like a tiger's eye closing in the jungle. Or, the road twists and knifes and gouges its way up the hillside, struggling until it reaches the rim, then disappears out of sight before bursting onto the horizon. These are director traps, seductive but unphotographable. Although the European writers of these passages lack screenwriting discipline, they are ingenuously trying to be expressive, whereas American writers, out of cynicism and laziness, often resort to sarcasm. Benny, in his 30s, is a small, muscular Englishman with an air of mania that suggests that at least once in his life he's bitten the head off a chicken. Or, you guessed it, here comes the sex scene. I'd write it, but my mother reads these things. Amusing, but these writers resort to bald telling, masked by sarcasm, because they haven't the craft, talent, or pride to create a scene that acts out the simplest of ideas. Eliminate we see, we hear. We doesn't exist. Once into the story ritual, the theater could be empty for all we care. Instead, we see injects an image of the crew looking through the lens and shatters the reader's vision of the film. Eliminate all camera and editing notations. In the same way actors ignore behavioral description, directors laugh at rack focus 2, pan 2, tight 2 shot on, and all other efforts to direct the film from the page. If you write track on, does the reader see a film flowing through his imagination? No. He sees a film being made. Delete cut to, smash cut to, lap dissolve to, and all other transitions. The reader assumes that all changes of angle are done on a cut. The contemporary screenplay is a master scene work that includes only those angles absolutely necessary to the telling of the story and no more. For example, slug line, all caps, interior dining room day. Jack enters, dropping his briefcase on the antique chair next to the door. He notices a note propped up on the dining room table. Strolling over, he picks up the note, tears it open, and reads. Then, crumpling the note, he drops into a chair, head in hands. If the audience knows the contents of the note from a previous scene, then the description stays on Jack reading and slumping into a chair. If, however, it's vital that the audience read the note with Jack, or it wouldn't be able to follow the story, then, slug line, interior dining room day. Jack enters, dropping his briefcase on the antique chair next to the door. He notices a note propped up on the dining room table. Strolling over, he picks it up and reads. Slug line. Insert note. Calligraphic handwriting reads, Jack, I've packed and left. Do not try to contact me. I have a lawyer. She will be in touch. Barbara. On scene. Jack crumples the note and drops into a chair, head in hands. A second example. If, as Jack sits head in hands, he were to hear a car pull up and hurry to a window, and it's critical to audience comprehension that they see what Jack sees at that moment, then, continuing from above, on scene. Jack crumples the note and drops into a chair, head in hands. Suddenly, a car pulls up outside. He hurries to the window. Slug line, Jack's POV through the curtains to the curb. Barbara gets out of her station wagon, opens the hatch, and takes out suitcases. Slug line, on Jack, turning from the window, hurling Barbara's note across the room. If, however, the audience would assume that the car pulling up is Barbara coming back to Jack, because she's done it twice before, and Jack's angry reaction says it all, then the description would stay on the master shot of Jack in the dining room. Beyond the essential storytelling angles, however, the master scene screenplay gives the writer a strong influence on the film's direction. Instead of labeling angles, the writer suggests them by breaking single-spaced paragraphs into units of description with images and language subtly indicating camera distance and composition. For example, slug line, interior dining room day. Jack enters and looks around the empty room. Then, lifting his briefcase above his head, he drops it with a thump on the fragile antique chair next to the door. He listens. Silence. Double space. Pleased with himself, he ambles for the kitchen, when suddenly he's brought up short. Double space. A note with his name on it sits propped against a rose-filled vase on the dining room table. Double space. Nervously, he twists his wedding ring. Double space. Taking a breath, he strolls over, picks up the note, tears it open, and reads. Rather than writing a thick block of single-spaced prose, lines of white, double spacing, splits this text into units that suggest an order. A wide angle covering most of the room, a moving shot through the room, a close-up on the note, an even tighter close-up on Jack's ring finger, and a medium follow shot to the table. The briefcase insult to Barbara's antique chair and Jack's nervous gesture with his wedding ring express his shifts of feeling. Actor and director are always free to improvise new business of their own, but the mini paragraphs lead the reader's inner eye through a pattern of action-reaction between Jack and the room, Jack and his emotions, Jack and his wife as represented in her note. That's the life of the scene. Now director and actor must capture it under the influence of this pattern. How exactly will be their creative tasks? In the meantime, the effect of the master scene technique is a readability that translates into the sensation of watching a film. Film is a magnificent medium for the poet's soul. Once the writer understands the nature of story poetics and its working within a film, poetic does not mean pretty. Rather, poetic means an enhanced expressivity. Whether a story's content is beautiful or grotesque, spiritual or profane, quietistic or violent, pastoral or urban, epic or intimate, it wants full expression. To begin with, as audience in the ritual of story, we react to every image, visual or auditory, symbolically. We instinctively sense that each object has been selected to mean more than the thing itself, and so we add a connotation to every denotation. When an automobile pulls up into a shot, our reaction is not a neutral thought such as vehicle. We give it a connotation. We think, Mercedes, rich, or Lamborghini, foolishly rich, rusted out Volkswagen, artist. The first step to turning an ordinary story into a poetic work is to exclude 90% of reality. The vast majority of objects in the world have all the wrong connotations for any specific film. So the spectrum of possible imagery must be sharply narrowed to those objects with appropriate implications. With a sense of what's appropriate, the writer then empowers the film with an image system, or systems, for there are often more than one. An image system is a strategy of motifs, a category of imagery embedded in the film that repeats in sight and sound from beginning to end. Category means a subject drawn from the physical world that's broad enough to contain sufficient variety. For example, a dimension of nature, animals, the seasons, light and dark, or a dimension of human culture, buildings, machines, art. This category must be repeated because one or two isolated symbols have little effect. Variety and repetition drive the image system to the seat of the audience's unconscious. Yet, and most importantly, a film's poetics must be handled with virtual invisibility and go consciously unrecognized. An image system is created one of two ways, via external or internal imagery. External imagery takes a category which, outside the film, already has a symbolic meaning, and brings it in to mean the same thing in the film it means outside the film. A spider's web to mean entrapment. A teardrop to mean sadness. External imagery, however, is the hallmark of the student film. Internal imagery takes a category which, outside the film, may or may not have a symbolic meaning attached, and brings it into the film to give it an entirely new meaning appropriate to this film and this film alone. For example, the film Diabolique. In 1955, director-screenwriter Henri Clouseau adapted Pierre Boulez's novel. In it, Christina is an attractive young woman, but very shy, quiet, and sensitive. She has suffered from a heart condition since childhood and is never in the best of health. Years before, she inherited an impressive estate in the suburbs of Paris that has been turned into an exclusive boarding school. She runs this school with her husband, Michel, a sadistic, abusive, malignant bastard who delights in treating his wife like dirt. He's having an affair with one of the school's teachers, Nicole, and he's as vicious and cruel to his mistress as he is to his wife. Everybody knows about this affair. In fact, the two women have become best friends, both suffering under the heel of this brute. Early in the film, they decide that the only way out of their problem is to kill him. One night, they lure Michel to an apartment in a village well away from the school, where they've secretly filled a bathtub full of water. He comes in, dressed in his three-piece suit, and arrogantly taunts and insults the two women, while they get him just as drunk as they possibly can, and then try to drown him in the bathtub. But he's not that drunk, and it's a hell of a struggle. The terror nearly kills the poor wife, but Nicole rushes into the living room and grabs a ceramic statue of a panther from the coffee table. She loads this heavy thing on the man's chest. Between the weight of the statue and her own strength, she manages to hold him down under the water long enough to drown him. The women wrap the body in a tarp, hide it in the back of a pickup truck, and sneak back to the campus in the middle of the night. The school swimming pool hasn't been used all winter. An inch of algae covers it. The women dump the body in, and it submerges out of sight. They quietly retire and wait for the next day when the body will float up and be discovered. But the next day comes and goes, and the body does not float up. Days go by, and the body will not float up. Finally, Nicole, accidentally on purpose, drops her car keys in the pool and asks one of the older students to retrieve them. The kid dives down under the scum and searches and searches and searches. He comes up, gulps some air, then goes down again and searches and searches and searches. He comes up to gulp air, then goes down a third time and searches and searches and searches. At last he surfaces with the car keys. The women then decide it's time to clean the swimming pool. They order the pool drained, and they stand on its edge, watching as the scum goes down and down and down and down to the drain. But there is no body. That afternoon, a dry cleaner's van drives out from Paris to deliver the cleaned and pressed suit that the man died in. The women rush into Paris to the cleaner's, where they find a receipt, and on it is the address of a boarding house. They head there and talk to the concierge, who says, "Yes, yes, there was a man living here, but he moved this morning." They go back to the school, and even more bizarre things happen. He appears and disappears in the windows of the school. When they look at the senior class graduation photo, there he is standing behind the students, slightly out of focus. They can't imagine what's going on. Is he a ghost? Did somehow he survive the drowning and he's doing this to us? Did someone else find the body? Are they doing this? Summer vacation comes, and all the students and teachers leave. Then Nicole herself. She packs her bag, saying she can't take this anymore, leaving the poor wife alone. That evening, Christina can't sleep. She sits up in bed, wide awake, her heart pounding. Suddenly, in the dead of night, she hears the sound of typing coming from her husband's office. Slowly she gets up and edges down a long corridor, hand on her heart. But just as she touches the office doorknob, the typing stops. She eases open the door, and there, alongside the typewriter, are her husband's gloves, like two huge hands. Then she hears the most terrifying sound imaginable, a dripping faucet coming from the bathroom off the office. Now she heads toward that door, her heart raging. She creaks open the bathroom door, and there he is, still in his three-piece suit, submerged in a bathtub full of water, the faucet dripping. The body sits up, water cascades off, its eyes open, but there are no eyeballs. Hands reach out for her, she grabs her chest, has a fatal heart attack, and drops dead on the floor. He reaches under his eyelids and removes white plastic inserts. Nicole jumps out of a closet. They embrace and whisper, "We did it." The opening titles of Diabolique look as if they're over an abstract painting of grays and blacks. But suddenly, as titles end, a truck tire splashes from bottom to top of the screen, and we realize we've been looking at the top-angle view of a mud puddle. The camera comes up on a rainy landscape, as the image system, water, is continually and subliminally repeated. It's always drizzly and foggy. Condensation on windows runs in little drops to the sills. At dinner, they eat fish. Characters drink wine and tea, while Christina sips her heart medicine. When the teachers talk about summer vacation, they're going to the south of France to take the waters. Swimming pool, bathtubs, it's one of the dampest films ever made. Outside this film, water is a universal symbol of all things positive, sanctification, purification, the feminine. archetype for life itself. But Clouseau reverses these values until water takes on the power of death, terror, and evil, and the sound of a dripping faucet brings the audience right up out of their seats. Casablanca weaves three image systems. Its primary motifs create a sense of imprisonment as the city of Casablanca becomes a virtual penitentiary. Characters whisper their escape plans as if the police were prison guards. The beacon on the airport tower moves through the streets like a searchlight scanning a prison compound, while window blinds, room dividers, stair railings, even the leaves of planted palms create shadows like the bars of prison cells. The second system builds a progression from the particular to the archetypal. Casablanca starts as a refugee center, but becomes a mini United Nations, filled not only with Arab and European faces, but African and Asian as well. Rick and his friend Sam are the only Americans we meet. Repeated images, including dialogue in which characters speak to Rick as if he were a country, associate Rick to America until he comes to symbolize America itself and Casablanca, the world. Like the United States in 1941, Rick is steadfastly neutral, wanting no part in yet another world war. His conversion to the fight subliminally congratulates America for finally taking sides against tyranny. The third system is one of linking and separating. A number of images and compositions within the frame are used to link Rick and Ilsa, making the subliminal point that although these two are apart, they belong together. The counterpoint to this is a series of images and compositional designs that separate Ilsa from Laszlo, making the opposite impression that although these two are together, they belong apart. Chinatown employs four image systems, two of external imagery, two of internal. The primary internalized system is motifs of blind seeing, or seeing falsely. Windows, rearview mirrors, eyeglasses, and particularly broken spectacles, cameras, binoculars, and eyes themselves, even the open, unseeing eyes of the dead, all gather tremendous force to suggest that if we're looking for evil out in the world, we're looking in the wrong direction. It is in here, in us. As Mao Zedong once said, history is the symptom. We are the disease. The second internalized image system takes political corruption and turns it into social cement. False contracts, subverted laws, and acts of corruption become that which holds society together and creates progress. Two systems of external imagery, water versus drought, and sexual cruelty versus sexual love, have conventional connotations, but are used with sharp-edged effectiveness. Going back through the decades, Hitchcock's thrillers combine images of religiosity with sexuality, while John Ford's westerns counterpoint wilderness with civilization. In fact, traveling back through the centuries, the writer discovers that image systems are as old as story itself. Homer invented beautiful motifs for his epics, as did Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides in their plays. Shakespeare submerged a unique image system into each of his works, as did Melville, Poe, Tolstoy, Dickens, Orwell, Hemingway, Ibsen, Chekhov, Shaw, Beckett. All great novelists and playwrights have embraced this principle. And who, after all, invented screenwriting? Novelists and playwrights who came to the cradles of our art in Hollywood, London, Paris, Berlin, Tokyo, and Moscow, to write the scenarios of silent films. Film's first major directors, such as D.W. Griffith, Eisenstein, Murnau, did their apprenticeship in the theater. They, too, realized, like a fine play, a film can be taken to the sublime by the repetition of a subliminal poetics. Professional writers may or may not receive critical acclaim, but they're in control of the craft, have access to their art, improve their performance over the years, and make a living from the art. A struggling writer may at times produce quality, But from day to day, he cannot make his talent perform when and as he wants, doesn't progress in quality from story to story, and makes little, if any, income from his efforts. On the whole, the difference between those who succeed and those who struggle is their opposed methods of work, inside out versus outside in. The struggling writer tends to have a way of working that goes something like this. He dreams up an idea, noodles on it for a while, then rushes straight to the keyboard. He imagines and writes, writes and dreams until he reaches page 120 and stops. Then he hands out Xerox copies to friends. He gathers friends' reactions and his own thoughts to start the second draft with this strategy. How can I keep the six scenes that I love and that everyone else loves and somehow pretzel this film through them in a way that'll work? He imagines and writes, writes and dreams, but all the while he clings like a drowning man to his favorite scenes until a rewrite comes out the other end. So he makes copies and hands them out to friends, and then back come friends' reactions. It's different, decidedly different. But I'm so glad you kept that scene in the garage, and with the kid in his pajamas, and the car blowing up, and the love scene on the beach. Great scenes. But there's still something about that ending, and the middle, and the way it starts, that just doesn't work for me. So the writer continues to write dialogue in search of scenes, write scenes in search of story, clinging rigidly to his favorite moments, until a year or more and a dozen drafts later, he quits in frustration. Writers who succeed use the reverse process. If, hypothetically and optimistically, a screenplay can be written from first idea to last draft in 6 months, this writer would typically spend the first 4 of those 6 months writing on stacks of 3x5 cards, a stack for each act, 3, 4 or more perhaps. On these stacks, the writer creates the story's step outline, 1 card per scene. As the term implies, a step outline is the story told in steps. Using 1 or 2 sentence statements, the writer simply and clearly describes what happens in each scene, how it builds and turns. On the back of each card, the writer indicates what step in the design of the story he sees the scene fulfilling, at least for the moment. Which scene set up the inciting incident? Which is the inciting incident? First act climax, perhaps a mid-act climax, second act, third, fourth, or more. He does this for central plot and subplots alike. He confines himself to a few stacks of cards for months on end for this critical reason. He wants to destroy his work. Taste and experience tell him that 90% of everything he writes, regardless of his genius, is mediocre at best. In his patient search for quality, he must create, then destroy that 90%. So he pours out 5, 10, 20 times more material than he can use. He may sketch a scene a dozen different ways before finally throwing the idea of the scene out of the outline. He may destroy sequences, whole acts. A writer secure in his talent knows there's no limit to what he can create, and so he destroys everything necessary on his quest for a gem-quality story. Finally, after weeks or months, the writer discovers the climax of the last act. With his story climax in hand, he reworks as needed backwards from it. At last he has a complete story. Now he goes to his friends, but not asking for a day out of their lives, which is what we ask when we hand a conscientious person a screenplay. Instead, he pours a cup of coffee and asks for 10 minutes. Then he pitches his story. The writer never shows his step outline to people because it's a tool too cryptic for anyone but the writer to follow. Instead, at this critical stage, he wants to tell or pitch his story so he can see it unfold in time, watch it play on the thoughts and feelings of another human being. He wants to look in their eyes and see the story happen there. So he pitches and studies the reactions. Is my friend hooked by the inciting incident, listening and leaning in? Or are his eyes wandering? Am I holding him as I build and turn the progressions? And when I hit the climax, do I get a strong reaction of the kind I want? Any story pitched from its step outline to an intelligent, sensitive person must be able to grasp their attention, hold their interest for 10 minutes, and pay it off by moving them to a meaningful emotional experience, just as Diabolique hooked, held, and moved you. Regardless of genre, if a story can't work in 10 minutes, how will it work in 110 minutes? It won't get any better when it gets bigger. Everything that's wrong with it in a 10-minute pitch is 10 times worse on screen. Until a majority of listeners respond with enthusiasm, there's no point in going forward. With enthusiasm doesn't mean people leap up and kiss you on both cheeks. Rather, they whisper, "Wow," and fall silent. A fine work of art, music, dance, painting, story, has the power to silence the chatter in the mind and lift us to another place. When a story, pitched from a step outline, is so strong it brings silence, no comments, no criticism, just a look of pleasure, that's a hell of a thing, and the writer's ready to move to the next stage, the treatment. To treat the step outline, the writer expands each scene from 1 or 2 sentences to a paragraph or 2 or 3 of double-spaced, present tense, moment-by-moment description. Slugline. Interior dining room day. Jack walks in and tosses his briefcase on the chair next to the table. He looks around. The room is empty. He calls her name, gets no answer. He calls it again, louder and louder. Still, no answer. As he pads to the kitchen, he sees a note on the table. Picks it up, reads it. The note says that she has left him for good. He drops in the chair, head in hand, and starts to cry. In treatment, the writer indicates what characters talk about. He wants her to do this, but she refuses, for example, but never, ever writes dialogue. Instead, he creates the subtext, the true thoughts and feelings underneath what is said and done. We may think we know what our characters are thinking and feeling, but we don't know we know until we write it down. Interior dining room day. The door opens, and Jack leans on the jamb, exhausted from a day of failed and frustrating work. He looks around the room and sees that she's not around, and hopes like hell she's out. He really doesn't want to have to deal with her today. To be sure he has the house to himself, he calls her name. Gets no answer. Calls out louder and louder. Still, no answer. Good. He's finally alone. Hungry, he heads for the kitchen, but as he crosses the room, he notices a note on the dining room table. It's one of those damned annoying notes that she's always leaving around, taped to the bathroom mirror or the refrigerator or whatever. Irritated, he picks it up and tears it open. Reading it, he discovers that she's left him for good. As his legs go weak, he drops into a chair, a knot twisting his gut. His head falls into his hands, and he starts to cry. He's surprised by his outburst, pleased he can still feel some emotion. But his tears are not grief. They're the dam breaking with relief that the relationship is finally over. The 40 to 60 scenes of a typical screenplay, underlaid with a full subtext of conscious and unconscious thoughts and feelings of all characters, will produce 60, 80, 90 or more double-spaced pages. Writing a screenplay from a thorough treatment is a joy, and often runs at a clip of 5 to 10 pages per day. We now convert treatment description to screen description and add dialogue. And dialogue written at this point is invariably the finest dialogue we've ever written. Our characters have had tape over their mouths for so long they can't wait to talk. Writing from the outside in, writing dialogue in search of scenes, writing scenes in search of story, is the least creative method. If we scratch out dialogue before we know what happens, we inevitably fall in love with our words. We loathe to play with and explore events, to discover how fascinating our characters might become, because it would mean cutting our priceless dialogue. All improvisation ceases, and our so-called rewriting is just tinkering with speeches. Writing from the outside in is not only the least creative way to work, it is also the longest way to work, because this process can go on for years before we finally realize that not all of our babies are going to walk and talk. Some of our work will be stillborn. Some ideas are simply not worth becoming a motion picture. Now, when do you want to find that out? 2 months from now or 2 years from now? If you write from the inside out, you'll realize quickly in the step outline that you can't get the story to work. Nobody likes it when pitched. In truth, you don't like it. So you toss it in the drawer. And maybe years from now you'll pick it up and solve it, but for now you go on to your next idea. Writing from the inside out, therefore, is not only the fastest way to work, but it is, of course, the most creative way to work. Working from step outline to treatment to first draft and revision arrives at the finest possible work that your talent will allow at this point in your career. I offer this with the realization that each of us must, by trial and error, find our own method, and that some rare talents do work from the outside in and produce remarkable results. The inside-out process, however, was developed over the centuries by the vast majority of novelists and playwrights who then passed it on to the screenwriter. It's a way of working both disciplined and free, designed to encourage our finest work.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life and select from one of the many available children's audiobooks?
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.